central bank digital currencies, digital IDs, artificial intelligence, and big tech surveillance. What does our digital future really look like? Join me, Alistair Harding, for a look into our digital future every Wednesday on Paul Brennan's Breakfast Show, right here on Reality Check Radio. Welcome to another episode of Our Digital Future on Reality Check Radio. My name is Alistair Harding, and today on Our Digital Future, we're following up on some of the big questions we've already come across in our first episodes as we've looked at central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. The questions that were raised in those interviews were firstly, what is the real need for a CBDC, since we already have digital currency? And secondly, what happens to the banks if they're suddenly in competition with our central bank? And thirdly, the question of what life would really be like under a CBDC system. So today we're going to talk about those questions and also reach further into the equations at play. First, I'm going to speak to Simon Angelo, a regular contributor on RCR, to talk about how CBDCs will affect the banking system. And then we're going to hear from another RCR regular contributor, Farzan Irani, who will tell us how India's CBDC trial is going and how he thinks that their nationwide Aadhaar digital ID is fast becoming critical to its success. But first, Simon Angelo is the Chief Executive Officer and publisher of Wealth Morning, and he also runs a wholesale night trading desk. But not only that, on the topic of our digital future, he worked for the world's first regulated Bitcoin fund in Europe in 2016. And more recently, he's been looking at the CBDCs in his Wealth Morning publication with an article titled, CBDCs, Is Evil Money Coming? Simon joins me now on Our Digital Future to talk CBDCs. Welcome, Simon Angelo.
Thank you very much, Alistair. It's wonderful having RCR back, I must say. Back at full strength too.
And since we've come back, we've been talking about our digital future, and a big part of that is the CBDC that the Reserve Bank are developing for New Zealand and asking for submissions for at the moment. However, in our first episode looking at CBDCs, I spoke to Michael Riddell, a central banker no less, and he told us on this show he sees no need for a CBDC in New Zealand. I also spoke to Catherine Austin Fitz, an investment banker of world renown, and she pointed out to me a clip from the head of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve saying the same thing. He's a man named Neil Kashkari, and he said that he didn't see any case for a CBDC either. So far, the only place I've been hearing about the need for a CBDC is from the Reserve Bank. But the last time I spoke to you off air, you didn't seem too concerned and thought that it was generally a good thing. So can you perhaps be the first person outside the Reserve Bank to make a case for a CBDC for me on this show?
Well, you're right. I have been on a journey with CBDCs. As your hand gets closer to the flame, you realize how hot things can burn, that's for sure. And I guess to background that journey, I mean, I come from a place, having returned from Europe just before the pandemic, New Zealand is a desert in terms of access to financial services, particularly banking and brokerage options, and particularly protected banking where your deposits are guaranteed. So initially I come from the place where more options are good. To make that case, Alistair, there's a lot of people who struggle with access to banking. Banking can be expensive when you don't have a high interest rate environment, you're having to pay fees, people have been debanked. You can't be a Luddite about these things. I mean, digital currencies hold huge power and huge potential. And when we were first involved in Bitcoin back in 2016, when it was just $500 a coin, we thought a lot of the potential would be as a means of transaction. You'd be able to use Bitcoin every day. But because it was really the early days of that cryptocurrency, we were essentially riding a motorbike naked. We didn't know where it would go. And in fact, it wasn't very transactable. It's become a speculative investment instrument because nobody wants to spend their Bitcoin because you're relying on the next person paying more for it. So from that perspective, I come from the view, well, a CBDC, an electronic currency guaranteed by the Federal Bank, by the Reserve Bank, could be a good thing. But then as you get closer to what that means and what the implications are, I mean, I grew up in Taranaki, and you don't need to pee on an electric fence to learn that it could be bad. And that's really why I've come around on CBDCs, particularly in terms of how they could disrupt the existing financial structure.
Okay, well, that's core to what you wrote about in Wealth Morning. How would it change our financial structure?
Well, you've got 700 years of banking that you're messing with. And go back to the Republic of Venice in the 15th century when banking was invented. The government was demanding loans to wage wars from merchants. And the only way to ensure that these loans would be repaid, would be monitored, that the lenders would get the 4% interest they were guaranteed, which in fact is the average interest rate over history, over the history of banking, about 4%. A chamber of loans was set up to provide this separation, this demarcation. And that chamber of loans monitored the loans and made sure they were repaid, made sure the interest was repaid. And it provided the separation between, the banking client and the state. And then, of course, merchants began to trust the chamber of loans, and they began to use it as they began to put their deposits with it. So what you're proposing with CBDCs is essentially an account where there's no demarcation, there's no disintermediation, there's no separation between the customer, the state, and the bank. You're essentially engaging directly with the provider of money. So how is this going to go? I mean, you start with the central bank issuing accounts. Presumably, if you put your money into a CBDC account, Alistair, you're then going to want an interest rate on it to keep your money there. How are they going to pay that interest? They're then going to have to lend that money out. I mean, if it looks like a bank, it smells like a bank, it is a bank, but it's controlled by the provider of money.
So what happens to the private banks that we deal with today? What happens to them in this equation?
Well, this is what I'm concerned about. I mean, initial work done suggests they could lose up to 10% of their deposits. That's speculative. I mean, I think it could go much further because obviously a central bank doesn't have the overhead or the intermediaries to deal with. They're essentially providing and running those accounts.
Does it mean that a bank that we deal with today, they would just become sort of a niche product provider for us? Is how would they survive?
Well, I mean, this I think really presents the danger of it. We don't know how far a CBDC will go, and we don't know what the impact on the banking industry will be. All you have to rely on is the promises from the central banks when they're putting this out that, well, no, we're not going to turn it into a lending product. We're not going to make it programmable. And the problem I have with it is these are bureaucrats running this as opposed to the innovation of the private market. Now, I think there has been an argument that central banks are becoming irrelevant. I don't believe that at all. I think central banks are extremely relevant because they control monetary policy. And really, they should do that with a single focus on keeping the inflation within the target of 0 to 2% or 0 to 3% as it is in New Zealand. That was the whole purpose of the Reserve Bank Act 1989. And of course, to supervise banks by regulating the amount of reserves that they keep. So really, to become the fox running the hen house on the basis that you're losing relevancy makes no sense at all to me. In fact, really opens a door to potential danger. I mean, Reserve Bank's not in charge of regulating the financial markets. I mean, that's something the FMA does. They really, in my view, need to stick to their knitting of ensuring stable, sound monetary policy.
That is a key theme that keeps coming up in the interviews that I'm doing about this, is that is this just a relevancy play by the Reserve Bank or central banks all over the world? Last I counted, there's 123 or 124 countries that have CBDC programs going on in one way or another. They're trialing them, they're researching them, they're piloting them. But there are some major countries that surprised me a little bit, actually, among them Denmark and Finland, two countries very similar to ours, and I also believe Japan might be one of them too, who've halted their work on CBDCs. They're presented as a fait accompli. They're presented as this is the future of our money system. Is it as decided as we're being told, or is there a lot more pushback against them that, than we're being told about?
Yes, I think there is a lot of pushback. I mean, you've mentioned Denmark, where the governor there very firmly pointed out that it could disrupt the financial system, the structure of it, and affect the demarcation of banks, exactly what we've discussed. And we're also seeing very strong pushback in the US. You've got presidential candidate Trump, who's saying he's not into them. You had Vivek Ramaswamy very clearly come out and say, well, no, I think these are dangerous. They pave the way really to a China social credit scoring type system. And he very clearly said, we are not China, for we are the US for a reason. We're different for a reason. And in fact, he believes that really the Federal Reserve has far too many people there working on these sorts of mission creep areas, and perhaps that their numbers could be reduced by 90%.
I also noticed there's about 8 or 9 states in the United States who've passed laws banning the use of CBDCs within their states. So there is a lot of pushback, isn't there?
Yes, there is. And I think people realize that this is an animal that bureaucracies created. You know, if you look at there's something called Purnell's iron law of bureaucracy. And it essentially means that those who are dedicated to benefiting and building a bureaucracy, they rise up and they push out those who are actually dedicated to its goals and mission. So you end up with people trying to build up a bureaucratic organization like a central bank, as opposed to actually trying to work out what goals are we trying to accomplish here. And the beast becomes the reason for existence. And that is the whole danger here, Alistair, with CBDCs, is it's almost sort of a pet project. Yes, it's modern, and it's digital currency. And to have a digital currency that we can transact, not like Bitcoin, which is a speculative instrument, is golden. But I just don't think central banks are the people to do it. And certainly not our Reserve Bank. I mean, just the level of mission creep. I mean, if you look at Thomas Cranmer on Twitter X, apparently they are now recruiting for a principal DEI advisor, diversity, equity, and inclusion. That is mission creep. I mean, there's a lot of controversy around these programs. Do they actually work? Do they improve your workforce? Well, no, they may actually just lead to racially profiling people.
When we first spoke about this, I mentioned about the programmability, and at that time, you didn't think it was such a huge thing. Why would they do it? I mean, money in all its forms, trust is at the center of money in all its forms. So if a government or a reserve bank was going to start programming it and make it harder for us to use or make us trust it less, then that would be counterintuitive to actually setting up a new money system. What are your thoughts now on the programmability situation with CBDCs? I mean, they're core to a CBDC. You can't have a CBDC without the programmability. Do you see it as a huge problem, or are you still thinking, well, why would they engage in that kind of behavior?
Well, if you look at their documentation, they've promised that that will not or would never be a potential use of a CBDC. And of course, as soon as they started doing that, you would damage their reputation wholeheartedly. Nobody would trust them. But these things, you just don't know where they could go. I mean, we're in an AI age now. Uber's already using artificial intelligence. Well, they have a patent on artificial intelligence to work out where you're going to call your next ride. So if you're using Uber, they have a patent on a system that's going to say, well, Alistair, we know where you're going to go next. Let's make sure there's some cars around you. Airbnb has some very clever AI, which is reducing the number of parties being held at host properties. They've drastically cut the number of parties. So you imagine if you apply artificial intelligence to a CBDC system. That intelligence could potentially work out, okay, this person could be a tax cheat. This person could be engaged in behavior that's disruptive or against the government. There's just no limit as to, once you've got this huge amount of information and there's no disintermediation and there's no demarcation, there's no separation of powers, you really just don't know where it's going to go. So although they're promising, no, it's not going to be programmable, of course that would wreck it, you just don't know what could be cooked up behind the scenes. And that's what makes me very, very nervous.
How much do you think your nervousness comes because of the era, the COVID era that we've just been through, where the government has ridden roughshod over our basic rights, our Bill of Rights, and all of those other things that they did during that time?
Oh, look, I grew up in the 80s and I saw the fall of the Berlin Wall. And this was meant to be our generation of freedom. And what's happened since the global financial crisis, and especially since the pandemic, is there's been more regulation and less freedom, and even more Marxist themes coming in through through discussion in national politics. And I think it's only now that people are really starting to push back and saying, well, no, freedom's important. What happened in communism is you had the system first, you had the rules and the structure first, then you developed the system and processes. I think people are saying, well, hang on, you've got such a large bureaucracy now, you know, a third of GDP here in New Zealand. You've got so many people who are first developing systems and processes that then enable further control. And you've got to have separation between the state, the provision of money, and the population.
Okay, so what's the solution then? Because it seems to me that we are in a digital age, and this is probably inevitable, if I put that to you. If this is inevitable, what do we do? What kind of laws do we put in place? Or what systems do we put in place to ensure that a government can't use them against the people that are using them? Or the other option is, do we just ditch this idea completely?
Well, just my opinion, I'd rather my taxpayer funds weren't spent on it, and central banks were laser focused on sound monetary policy and stable inflation between 0 to 2, maybe 3%, without mission creep. But I think really what you want is a well-regulated private financial system which encourages innovation. And we have had huge innovation in cryptocurrency. There's been some regulation to make that safer. But you're also having other products appear like digital wallets. I mean, slight disclaimer here, I am an investor in Wise and Wise PLC, but they have a very effective card and an app where you could essentially spend money around the world in an app. It's all digital and it's disintermediated from central banks.
And we can see those working all over the world already, right? I mean, in China, they've got things like Alipay and WeChat Pay, which are private companies. And essentially, they're giving the same service that our Reserve Bank is promising us with a CBDC, aren't they?
Well, yes, the money is still electronic. That's right. And they're regulated under global banking systems. You know, they set up offices wherever they're within the jurisdictions where they're offering the card. So I would like to see more innovation in that area, and particularly perhaps more stable coins, which are more transactable rather than speculative investment instruments.
Okay, what happens if New Zealand gets off the train at this point? What happens then if the rest of the world does go down the track of the CBDC and we don't? What are we set to lose if we get off the train right now?
Well, there is the argument that mainly access to money and banking, because it is a very small banking sector in New Zealand, and of course the lead players are Australian, apart from Kiwi Bank. So when you have other jurisdictions that, you know, successfully offer a CBDC and they find it working well, we may look over with some degree of envy. But really, I see more of a pushback now, especially as you mentioned those states in the US banning it, countries like Denmark and Finland, which have among the more trusted, although large, public services, they are saying they're not going to proceed with it. So I think there's more pushback, and there's perhaps more potential harm than good that could come from this.
Hey, thank you so much for your time today, Simon. It's been great to hear your thoughts and also to hear about the progression from not being rather ambivalent about it, coming through all the way to today, to actually starting to see the reasons why we shouldn't be going down this track.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Alistair.
That's Simon Angelo, the Chief Executive Officer and publisher of Wealth Morning. And if you want to hear more about what Simon has to say on all things money, you can find his online publication, Wealth Morning, at www.wealthmorning.com. That's www.wealthmorning.com. Some of the points that Simon brings up in that interview would ring alarm bells in anyone who values their privacy. For me, after interviewing Dr. Robert Epstein in our first episode of Our Digital Future, Simon's thoughts about how AI could be used to gather our spending data and surveil and manipulate us is of particular concern to me. But what if a CBDC was compulsory? And what if it was impossible to pay for basic services like electricity and water and internet without a CBDC? Well, to speak about that, and how it might come to pass, I now have for you an interview with regular RCR contributor Fazin Irani. Fazin is the managing director of Success Simplified and has a successful banking and financial services career spanning over 20 years in India, New Zealand, and Australia, and thus has a unique insider's view on how our global financial system works. And not only that, currently, he's in India spending time with his family, and because of that, he's got a unique view on how the current Indian CBDC trial is going, and also how the Aadhaar Digital ID has become an integral piece of digital infrastructure that could potentially take a CBDC from something that no one really pays much attention to the currency of control that Catherine Austin Fitz has warned us about. So welcome, Fazin. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Alistair. It's a pleasure being here.
Okay, so you're in India right now. Could you tell us, what's it like living with a CBDC? Does it change life for you at all?
If I'm being honest, Alistair, the CBDC is in its pilot program stages right now. So the everyday person hasn't been allowed to use it yet. It's been trial since last year with 8 banks in India, all over India, and only certain merchants are being allowed to use it, and only certain few customers in India are being allowed to use it. So it's in its trial stages only at this stage, rather than it's not your digital rupee being used with everyday transactions for every single person in India. And that's also because India already has quite a good digital setup for money through your Google Pays, your Amazon Pays, and all those UPI platforms.
So who is actually using it during the trial?
At the moment, it's just banks who have decided to put it through certain merchants who are allowed to use it. So not everyone's allowed to use it. And only certain clients or certain customers that the bank personally taps on the shoulder and says, hey, can you trial the central bank digital currency for us in a retail setting? So if you understand, obviously, CBDC has a wholesale CBDC and a retail CBDC. So this is the trial of the retail CBDC, but only certain few people are being asked to use it. So they have to download digital wallets from their banks. For an example, I've gone on my own bank's website out here, and it has a little button on there saying CBDC wallet. When I click on it, it opens into an app store and it has a wallet there, but it says it's not available in your country right now. So I'm assuming only some people are allowed to download that. So you already know there's an app ready to go for every single person in the country.
Okay, so it's all ready to go. It's on your phone. You can actually, you can see where it's gonna be, but it's not there for you yet. I also understand that they had a target of wanting to have X amount of transactions by this time, and they fell a little bit short. So they made it compulsory for banks, for bank workers to take their bonuses in it. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Obviously, no one's wanting to use this because there's no use case and it just doesn't make any sense But hey, we've got to go ahead with it. So the Reserve Bank of India, which obviously started the pilot, as I said, a couple of years back, December 2022. But the transaction averaged only about 25,000 a day by the end of October then. And because they have to prove a significant use case to try and say, look, this is really being used by everyone, everyone's loving it, they have now kind of forced large private organizations and even state-run government organizations to disperse salaries in the CBDC. So they're kind of essentially forcing people to accept it. And yeah, that's what they're trying to do, just to get the numbers up, right?
Yeah. Okay. So it's not compulsory. It's just mandatory. Okay. So then the next question is over the last few weeks, we've been talking about CBDCs and everyone I've spoken to has not been able to give me a good reason for a CBDC. We have BDCs already all over the world. Have they been able to articulate in India why you need a CBDC in India?
No, they haven't. And they won't be able to because as most of the people you've interviewed and people who can think for themselves, there is no use case for a CBDC. Now, CBDC already technically stands for Central Bank Digital Currency. We already have BDC, as you mentioned, which is your bank digital currency. So we already have electronic money on our phones through our banking apps and the UPIs, which I've already mentioned. So in India, what's happened is UPIs have become a really big payment method. UPI stands for Unified Payments Interface. So essentially what you do is link your bank account to a Google Pay, and you can link as many bank accounts. So you could have three or four different bank accounts linked to your Google Pay. And technically, you can pay somebody in an instant, on the go, so to speak. So the government's kind of happy that UPIs have been introduced in the Indian market because I can pay someone instead of paying someone cash and not having the exact change or having to carry cash with me. I can just Google Pay someone the exact dollar amount, or sorry, an exact rupee amount with either a phone number or a QR code. So while I've been in India, what I've realized is a lot of people even buy a cup of chai, which is a cup of tea, which only costs about 20 rupees with a scanned QR code. The smallest transactions are now just scanned. Soon, I was joking with a friend the other day that a beggar might keep a QR code next to him just so you can scan his QR code and pay him with that. But you can either pay someone with a QR code or a mobile number. All you need is a person's mobile number or a QR code to instantaneously pay them through a UPI. So CBDC would be essentially a similar thing. But as you mentioned, why is that extra C at the end of BDC? It's central bank liability, as you've interviewed a few other people. And the Bank for International Settlements has clearly said it is a central bank liability, and they will be able to keep an eye on every single rupee or dollar or peso being spent, because right now cash is anonymous.
And the other part that we need to talk about is the digital IDs, how that ties into it all. And in India is probably the place in the world where they've gone down the furthest down the track with the digital IDs. You guys have over there an Aadhaar ID. Can you tell me about the Aadhaar ID?
Yeah, sure. It's called Aadhaar, which technically in Hindi or Indian word means foundation. Now that tells you something. It's the foundation of something, okay? In January 2009, firstly, just to get some background, as I said, a lot of these plans have been put in place. In January 2009, the government created kind of an organization called UIDAI, which is Unique Identification Authority of India. Now think back, this is long time back, okay? This is January 2009, and it was set up to get biometric and demographic data from the citizens, which is your iris scans, your fingerprints, and all of that. Now, if you think about why this happened in 2009, the government justified saying, we don't know who's in our country because there had been a terrorist attack in Mumbai and some cities in 2008. So yes, the government had justification to say, hey, we really don't know who's in our country. So let's create this organization so we'll collect biometric data. And I'm not saying those two were connected, but obviously the government has a right to do that because there were terrorists entering the country. Now there's a reason to get this organization up and running. The organization then says, let's get this system called Aadhaar card. So what is the Aadhaar card? It's a 12-digit unique ID number issued by the government and it's only for residents of India. It was technically launched in 2012, but by now it is already the largest digital ID system on the planet with about 1.3 billion IDs issued. And this is only by 2021. So 92% of India's population is already covered, and they already have this thing called Aadhaar card, which is a 12-digit unique ID number. And to get it, you have to give them all your 10 fingerprints. You have to have your two iris scans. You have your facial recognition also taken at. And from time to time, the first entry is free. And from time to time, you have to keep updating all your biometric data. So now the government has everything about you in one central system, which is linked to your 12-digit Aadhaar card.
Is this actually compulsory or is this voluntary? I understood that this was voluntary.
The Aadhaar card is supposed to be voluntary. Most people do not know that it is voluntary, and I've looked into it, and the government is quite happy to not publicize or let people know that it is not mandatory. Even my family members and my friends think it's mandatory, because you essentially can't get any services in India without this Aadhaar card. So it's being hidden from the public that it's a totally voluntary ID. You don't have to sign up for it. And I can give you an example where this was challenged in the Supreme Court of India because it is seen as discrimination if you don't, you can't receive services if you don't have an Aadhaar card. And the Supreme Court has clearly said that the project was unconstitutional as it allowed profiling of citizens, but the government has still carried on.
So the Supreme Court has actually ruled that it, I notice here you've given me some notes and you say on the 11th of August 2015, the Supreme Court directed the government to widely publicize in print and electronic media that Aadhaar was not mandatory for any welfare scheme. And then later on, and as recently as 2018, the Supreme Court has ruled Section 57 of the Aadhaar Act is unconstitutional, but yet you have to use it for absolutely everything. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Alistair. You need it to have gas connection. So this started off saying, and this is what I'm saying, there's creep, there's government creep on this. They've slowly introduced and say it's only for good reasons, and people just need to connect the dots and think through the process. It was only so we could help poor people in villages and give them the social security and give them discounted gas connections, okay? It was to help the poor, subsidize gas connections, subsidize electricity. Now, obviously, what you can't do is even somebody living in Mumbai in a metropolitan city, you cannot get a gas connection without an Aadhaar card. So you can't cook for your family. You cannot have electricity without an Aadhaar card. You cannot have Wi-Fi at home without an Aadhaar card. And in fact, when I come to India, I need a mobile phone to use, right? I cannot even get a SIM card without an Aadhaar card.
As the Supreme Court has ruled, it can't be mandatory. It has to be voluntary. So how do they get away with that? Surely you must be able to sign up for gas or a SIM card with some other form of ID, surely?
No. In a simple word, no is the answer, because now every organization just asks for Aadhaar card. A bank account, you need an Aadhaar card. Because, the explanation was India is just trying to move to a digital future. So they had something which is a PAN card, which is for your tax purposes. They have a driver's license, they have your voter ID registration, they have all of these three, four, five different documents. So what they're trying to say is, hey, we've linked all of these to your Aadhaar card anyway, so just use your Aadhaar card for everything. So it's a digital, we're moving to a digital India, right? This is the pretext, and we're going to make everything so easy for you. Now, obviously, as you've just read, and I provided you the actual stuff, Supreme Court has said it's unconstitutional. It is profiling of citizens. There can be no discrimination if somebody does not have Aadhaar. But now, if you go to a bank and say, can I open a bank account? Or I've actually been to a Vodafone store in here and said, I just want a SIM card while I'm on holiday. No, you cannot have it because you have an Aadhaar card. So I have to either ask my sister to use her Aadhaar card, take a SIM card in her name so I can use. This is how ridiculous it's gotten, even though it is voluntary and not mandatory. And this is what I'm saying. The Supreme Court had actually directed the government to widely publicize in print and electronic media that the Aadhaar was not mandatory. Now, let's say even if they did that in the newspapers, how many people did read it? And a Vodafone or a bank can say, hey, we're a private organization. We want an Aadhaar card, or go to another bank. Now, if you go to another bank and they ask you for the same thing, unfortunately, you cannot have it.
How long have you been in India this time, and what's it like to live without an Aadhaar card? Is it possible to live without the digital ID? For all those people who are thinking, well, if that comes to New Zealand, I'm just not going to get it. Is it actually possible to live without one?
I would say it's very difficult, if near impossible, not near impossible, to live without an Aadhaar card, because you essentially, as I've just explained, you can't, if you're an Indian citizen living here, you can't survive without it.
I mean, how secure is the information on there? You've basically got everything about yourselves. You've got your iris scans, you've got your fingerprints. Yet there were media reports last year in November that the Aadhaar data had been hacked, leading to 60% of the data being leaked online. That's about 815 million people now with compromised phone numbers, passport numbers, ages, genders, addresses, even PIN codes amongst all of that information. How secure is this information, and have they done anything about it since that hack?
I'm not inside on the government, so I wouldn't know, but the government's constantly reassuring people that don't worry, nothing to look here. We've got it all secure. It's the most secure system, and Silicon Valley seems to say, oh, Aadhaar's amazing, and it's a very secure system. I'll give you an idea. It has been hacked, and I'll give you two examples as well. The story you might be talking about was, obviously there was an anonymous hacker who claimed to have breached the digital ID numbers, Aadhaar card, and stole the personal data of 815 million Indian citizens in one fell swoop, right? That's all the data, their fingerprints, their bank accounts, their mobile numbers, all of that. And guess how much he was willing to sell it for? Only $80,000. That's how much it's worth to the hacker, obviously. It's not worth much. But the whole thing is, what I can tell you now is, in the last few years, the RBI, also the Reserve Bank of India, has literally ads on television running out here saying, please do not share your Aadhaar number with anyone. Do not, because there's a lot and lot of scams going on through WhatsApp in India. Because everything is now linked to your mobile number through this Aadhaar card. You get a WhatsApp link, you click on it, suddenly your phone is hacked, and there you go. I know, I can give you two examples of people I know who have got calls saying, hey, listen, we're calling from customs and you sent a package somewhere and we found cocaine in it and all that stuff, or we found drugs in it. So now we need your Aadhaar card just to make sure it wasn't you who posted it out to this country and all that stuff. And the second example I wanted to give you, Alistair, and this is going to turn out to be quite a joke for you. This organization, which I said, the Unique Identification Authority of India, in 2018, Mr. R.S. Sharma, who was former Director General of the UIDAI, shared his Aadhaar number on Twitter, challenging people to show one concrete example where they could do any harm to him. Okay, this is the Director General of the organization that manages people's Aadhaar data of billions of people around the country. And this is what happened. Within hours, Twitter users managed to dig out his personal details, like his personal mobile number, Gmail and Yahoo addresses, physical address, his date of birth, his frequent flyer number, and that also he uses an iPhone. Literally after this incident, he tweeted urging people not to share their Aadhaar numbers online, right? So this is the Director General, who was so confident and cocky, and within hours, the new way he lived, his date of birth, whether he was using an iPhone, everything, his everything. This is how ridiculous the system is. If it's online, it's hackable.
Okay, final question time. To finish off, I just want to go back to the Indian CBDC trial, because you're a money guy, and I think I need to get your opinion on this. And I'd also like to perhaps push back a little bit, test the idea a little bit. In the context of this story, we've heard a lot about the way CBDCs are programmable, and the inference is that governments and central banks could use that function to coerce us and surveil us and ultimately control us. But as Michael Riddell pointed out in the first part of our CBDC series, money is based on trust. So like I say, you're a money guy, you understand this. What chance is there of this sort of control that we're talking about actually happening at all, if all it does is reduce trust in the currency? I mean, isn't that game over? Isn't that what stops a CBDC being used for evil?
Yes. What gives money or currency its value is the trust in government. That's what fiat currency is. Without trust, money doesn't exist. But have you thought about this? Why do we keep talking about something called digital IDs. So the money doesn't come first. The digital ID cage comes first. Again, we were talking about the Aadhaar card. In India, the example of a digital ID, they've got this thing called digital locker. Okay, they already have this thing called DigiLocker, where Aadhaar card, again, you need an Aadhaar card to get a DigiLocker. But in that, then you have all your government IDs, all your paperwork, even your CV and all of that stuff, even your land documents, ownership documents. Now, that is a digital lock. They actually call it DigiLocker. So they have locked you in the system, and the European Union is already talking about a digital identity. So what are these electronic systems like Aadhaar, DigiLocker, digital identity? Is essentially one place where all your data will be stored. Now, once this has come in, and now they launch a CBDC, which is your digital cash, as they like to call it, because everything's digital cash, digital ID, they don't need you to trust them, okay? You're locked in the system because they have all your data, and hey, Alistair, I don't need you to trust me anymore. You either use our digital cash or your driver's license ain't gonna work, or you use our digital cash, and that's the only thing you can use to get the registration on your car or to pay for your health insurance. Or we've been through this experiment, okay? The COVID thing was a soft experiment, if I'm being honest. How far can a government push you to accept certain things?
Farzan, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real pleasure listening to your thoughts and hearing what's been going on in India. I'm really hoping that we find somebody in Nigeria to talk to about this as well, because there's a huge story there as well. But in the meantime, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate you coming on and explaining what's going on in India.
Thanks, mate. It's a pleasure.
That's Farzan Irani, who is one of our regular RCR contributors, telling us about what's happening with the CBDC trial in India, and also how the Indian digital ID, the Aadhaar card, is now almost impossible to live without in India. So far on Our Digital Future, over the past few weeks, we've heard about how our digital footprints leave us open to surveillance and manipulation, and possibly control. We've heard about how central bank digital currencies are controlled by central banks and also programmable, making it possible for them to control us too. And today we've heard about what that means for the future of banks, and how when tied to a digital ID, a digital currency system is wide open for abuse. But who in power would abuse such a system? Well, next week I have with me an international, world-renowned economist who will tell us who in power would abuse such a system. It's going to be an episode you don't want to miss. But until then, my name is Alistair Harding, and you've been listening to Our Digital Future only on Reality Check Radio.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom. Simply visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference today.